Welcome to Capon Ray Hall, nestled in the beautiful landscapes between England's national parks. As a Bible school, we offer short-term courses aimed at fostering your spiritual growth and living in a community. Our historic manor house has something for everyone. You can enjoy indoor and outdoor adventures, connect with students from around the world, and learn how to deepen your relationship with Jesus Christ. Search Capon Ray England for more information.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. I'm Tim White. We hope you all had a wonderful Christmas. As my dad and I are still digesting our festive feasts, today's episode will continue the conversation between John and Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, which we began last week. It was hosted by Premier Unbelievable's Justin Brierley. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome back to The Big Conversation. I'm joined today by John Wyatt and Lord Martin Rees. We're talking about robots, transhumanism and life beyond Earth. As ever, there are links to both my guests from today's show. We're going to continue talking about sort of the interesting dilemmas and challenges that the advent of robotics and advanced robotics plays in the world today. Here's another clip that I'll share from two robotics experts. Again, this is Nigel Crook and David Levy. This time talking about the way that robots are increasingly providing care, even developing sometimes romantic relationships, whether that's a possibility in the future. Let's hear what they have to say. We're already seeing, I think, in places like Japan, robotics starting to be integrated into healthcare and care for the elderly in particular. And you can see the advantages of that in terms of saving on human resources and the ability for robotic companions and things to be there day and night and in all kinds of circumstances. At the same time, what are your feelings about effectively replacing human care with machine care?
I don't think we should ever do it. I think that technology like robotics and AI should be used to augment human care, if possible. The issue in Japan and the issue will be in this country within the next 50 years is there won't be enough people to maintain the same level of care that we currently have.
We have an aging population.
We have an aging population, so that there won't be enough younger people to fulfill that role. And so for me, the question is, how can this technology be used to augment the care that humans give rather than replace it?
And why is that important for you, that we don't simply replace human care with machine care?
Because, again, these are vulnerable people, and human-to-human interaction is always going to be far better to me than machine-to-human interaction.
I suppose my next natural question, though, is if you could create the kind of robot that, for all intents and purposes, looks, acts, and feels like a human, would you be effectively giving that person, you know, human-to-human care?
That is a really good question, and I'm not sure about the answer to that. It's possible that we could reach that level of realism within a very specific scenario. But the problem for me is that that robot would have to experience so much of life to be able to truly empathize with that individual, that makes it beyond reach as far as I'm concerned at the moment. What you could do is you could have a monitoring system or simple interaction with an elderly person which keeps them engaged, perhaps helps them to remember their past, shows them photographs of their past and enables them to sort of keep that sort of memory alive. But you would also need that human-human interaction as well, I feel.
When it comes to advances in robots that are used for sex, for relationships, for perhaps companionship and other things, generally, are you quite positive about movements in that direction?
I'm very positive. And the reason I'm so positive is that I see robots as being the answer to the prayers of all those millions of people all over the world who are lonely because they have no one to love and no one who loves them. And for these people, they might have psychological problems, they might have psychosexual problems, social problems, they might not be appealing to the people they would like to be appealing to, all sorts of reasons. they have a huge void in their lives, and this void will be filled when there are very human-like robots around with whom they can form emotional attachments, have sexual relationships, and even marry them.
Is that not an indictment, though, of humans that we are not fulfilling, that there are so many people who are lonely? Is it not something of an abnegation of our duty to be caring for each other rather than simply saying, well, let the robots do it?
I don't think it's realistic to believe that we could possibly be sufficiently caring for each other to take care of the huge number of people who suffer from such problems. I think that robots are really the only answer. A lot of people ask the question, why is it better to be in love with or have sex with a robot than with a human? To my mind, that's the wrong question. I think the real question is it better to have love and sex with robots or no love and sex at all?
Is there a danger that we change the way we think about sexuality and romance if essentially you're doing something to a subject rather than it being something that can equally have its own range of emotions and will and psychology and so on?
To some extent. I mean, there are people who argue that sex robots objectify women because most sex robots in the first instance are going to be female in form. I disagree. I don't think they objectify women. I think what sex robots do is to humanize robots. So I don't see a problem there at all.
Lots to respond to in that those two very different views on the role of robots in caring and even romantic relationships. Martin, you look like you want to respond immediately. Go ahead.
Well, there's an inconsistency, isn't there, in that if you think that these robots are going to be realistic enough and human-like enough to be emotional partners, as it were, then shouldn't one consider their feelings and say, do they want to be linked with this repulsive person? You've got to ask that question. And so I think there's an inconsistency in the aim of what's being said, that if they are sufficiently like a human to be a substitute, then we have to think about their feelings.
Yes, absolutely. Well, robot rights and so on. I mean, John, what I suppose these are the dilemmas that are thrown up by all of this, isn't it, John? What's your feeling on those?
Yes, I don't think we're going to get there, no. but those who take this view seriously are going to have to worry about this for consistency.
Yeah. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this is a fascinating point about... we all understand the difference between rape and consensual sex, and yet the question is exactly that. If you have a sex robot who is to all intents and purposes behaving like a human being, then do you have to ask consent? Do you have to take their feelings into account? And if you're so repulsive that no human being wants to have intimate relations with you, then maybe, you know, there is a very serious element to all this. I mean, we're partly making it humorous, but there's a very serious element to this, and it is this confusion. What I see happening is that previously, until this point, we all pretty well agreed that there was a kind of fairly clear barrier between where we were having relationships with other human beings and where we were having, quotes, relationships with beings that were non-humanoid, you know. And yes, it's true that the little girl has her teddy bear or her doll and talks to it and so on. But actually, the little girl knows perfectly well that this is not a real baby. And that when the little girl actually meets a real baby, she behaves in a completely different way from the way that she would behave with a doll. So we, up until this point, we've always had... psychologically and relationally, this understanding that there's a difference. And now what we're doing is we're creating this third entity, this blurring, where it's not really human, but it's almost human. And then how do I respond to this? And my greatest concern is with children who grow up with this. If your earliest experience as your earliest memories are talking to Alexa and playing with your robotic dog, you know, what does that do? And Sherry Turkle, who's a very thoughtful commentator on all this, she has written, the problem will not be, will we come to love our robots? The question will be, what will love mean? In other words, it's that redefinition of relationships and in particular a kind of transactional relationship. I mean, historically, and I think this is where this is partly from a Christian perspective, that we, Christians and others have always understood human relationships as touching on something immensely profound. You know, the, at their highest level, this reaching out to another, of giving to another, and so on, is something deeply profound. And what's being replaced by is this kind of transactional understanding that I press these buttons, this thing smiles at me, it makes me feel happy. That's a relationship.
Do you share those concerns as well, Martin?
Yes, I couldn't have expressed them so well, but I completely agree with that reaction to this scenario. Completely agree.
I mean, given that robots, you know, perhaps we're not at the stage where people are really attaching full-on romantic relationships with robots, but we are seeing in places like Japan, you know, an elderly population increasingly being serviced by autonomous robots of some kind, you know, and there being sort of at least companionship given by algorithmic robots and so on. Again, Martin, is it just practically, you know, do we just take a pragmatic view and say, well, if there aren't enough people to go around, that's, you know, that's the way we'll have to do it. We'll have to employ the services of robots that have a kind of quasi-human relationship with people. Or do you think we should actively strive to not go down that road, Martin?
Well, I think we should strive very hard not to. And of course, it'll be easier to avoid that route if we're prepared to have massive redistribution of funds so as to publicly support large numbers of people who will act as carers for the old and assistants to teachers to look after the young, etc. So I think we should try very, very hard to provide care for all who need it from real human beings. And this is in the interests of both those who might otherwise be unemployed if they're not sort of digitally expert. They've got to have some employment where being human is important. And also, I think it's more dignified for an individual to be looked after by another human being.
Well, why do you say it's more dignified? What is it about the human interaction that you can't replicate the dignity of with a robot?
Well, you think that there's an entity that really cares about you. And you're not convinced that that is the case for any of these robots.
Mm. So it's in that sense, it's feeling like you're interacting with someone who is like you and has the same sort of feelings and desires and
yes.
compassion mm-hmm. and so on. John, where does your kind of concern come from? Is it a similar place to Martin?
Well, I think it's very interesting, isn't it, that one of the fundamental drives we have as human beings, and from a Christian point of view, we would say this is part of our being created in God's image, is our desire and longing for truth. For authenticity, for meaning and significance. And therefore, however clever the simulation and the simulacrum, it is ultimately still a simulacrum. I've been doing a thought experiment, trying to get my head around this. And I was thinking, suppose I've been happily married for nearly 40 years. Suppose it turns out that my wife is actually a Russian agent in deep cover. And that unknown to me, she has her own handler and she's been playing this part for 40 years. Suppose I go to my grave and I never know that she actually was a double agent. Does it matter? Because I thought I had a happy marriage. I enjoyed the marriage. And actually, I think most of us would say, yes, it does matter because we were living a lie. And it matters, truth, authenticity matters. And that's why I think that gets at the heart of what Martin said about the dignity of being cared for. You know, you think of this elderly person, perhaps slightly confused, who thinks that this program is genuinely cares about her and is there for her and is compassionate. And actually, it's all clever programming. And intuitively, we recoil and we say there's something wrong about that. There's something inauthentic. Could I just say something else about this question of, I often hear this narrative, and that is, there are just not enough people to do the caring. And like Martin, I would totally want to push back against that, Because, of course, it is true that there is an acute shortage of carers in our community and across many Western countries. But the reason for that is that their terms and conditions, their pay, the way their status, the way they're treated, is that they're regarded as absolutely the bottom of the rung. And, you know, there's no shortage of people wanting to do MBAs and wanting to become commercial lawyers and so on. And so the challenge we've got is to reimagine the caring, the human caring role as something to be regarded as with, you know, as a high status, dignified, well-trained, well-paid job. And, I think there are more than enough human beings to take on that job if we can only present it in that way.
Martin, go ahead.
I completely agree with that. And, of course, those who are going to be displaced first by robotic advances are those in the mind-numbing jobs, like call centres. And they need to be given some more fulfilling role. And among those roles would be carers.
Yeah.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I mean, turning from the issue of the jobs and the roles and the ways in which, you know, potentially robotics may be a help, but may also start to change the way we interact with each other and think about relationships and so on. I mean, there are also the ethical implications of the way in which we're handing over so many responsibilities to AI, to machines, and so on. You know, one of the most often talked about one is self-driving cars, which are becoming a reality now. We are seeing self-driving cars starting to pop up, and, you know, the laws being put in place that would allow for that kind of a reality. But then at the same time, you know, we hear about these thought experiments what kind of decisions will a self-driving car make when it is faced with either going off the road and hitting the lady with her pram or hitting, you know, someone else on the other side and so on. Someone's, I suppose, got to be programming the ethics, haven't they, of these robots and so on. Martin, what's your thoughts on this? Are you concerned by the fact that we are having to effectively create moral, you know, sort of impart some kind of moral view to our robots? Is that, again, just an inevitable part of the progress of technology? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, we certainly have to do this. We confront what philosophers call the trolley problem in deciding how a robotic car reacts in an emergency. And I personally think, actually, it'll be a long time before we have the so-called stage 5 fully driverless cars, where the passenger could sit in the back as though they've got a chauffeur. I think that'll be a very long time coming. I think what we are facing immediately is lots of decisions which affect us, which are being taken by AI. And of course, AI has the advantage that it can work through a huge volume of data very quickly. But I certainly think that if we are going to be recommended for parole if we're in prison, or given recommended for an operation, or anything like that, or even denied credit by a bank, then we ought to be able to contest that decision. It's not enough to say it's been done by a robot, which on the whole has a better record than a human of consistent judgment. We want to be able to contest this. Going back to what Jim said, robots can be helpful. I mean, I know in the medical area, in radiology, a robot can have scanned 100,000 chest x-rays to look at signs of cancer and things like that, which is more than any human doctor could in a lifetime. And so, obviously, that's one example where the AI can help with diagnosis by a real doctor, and there are many cases like that. But I think to delegate any important decision to a machine when we can't question it and can't be sure there aren't some emergent bugs in the program is very dangerous, and we are heading that way already.
Go ahead, John.
Yes, I think this is a really important issue which we're wrestling with in healthcare, because it's absolutely right that advances in deep learning technology are bringing all kinds of new possibilities, including interpretation of scans and pathology results, and basic science insights and so on. And one of the interesting things that this kind of automation technology does is it decomposes traditional professional roles. So whereas previously we thought we knew what a medical doctor did, what their role was, what their training was, and so on. And what increasingly AI is doing is it's decomposing the different tasks that doctors do. And increasingly, many of the tasks that doctors have done in the past will now be better done by machines. And then the question is, well, what is it? What's the value added? What is it that the human being brings? And do we need to train a physician and spend $1 million and so on in training a human being? And I think there is definitely an important role. And I think of it particularly that there is that part of what, as a patient, when you're facing catastrophe and a disaster, you want somebody with humanity and wisdom. And the role of the physician, it seems to me, is to be a wise friend. And that means using all the information provided by the technology, but ultimately providing that human wisdom, which is what you so desperately need when you're in this very vulnerable position as a patient. And I think that it's going to be a challenge, because who takes the responsibility? And, if the doctor makes a decision based because the AI has said the scan shows this, and it then turns out the programming was faulty, who carries liability, who carries responsibility? And interestingly, the problem with these deep learning systems is that you cannot question them. You can't interrogate them and say, why did you come to this conclusion and not that conclusion? At least with a human being, you can say, why did you think it was cancer? And they've actually got, you can push back.
Does that concern you, Martin, the idea that we're kind of developing almost black boxes in their own light, these self-learning machines? So I know that, for instance, these amazing computers that have, learned Go in 24 hours and then beat the world grandmaster of Go and so on. Even the people building the machine don't really know how it did it. It just, looked at the rules and started to do its algorithmic thing. So it's almost as though we are already creating machines that are kind of going off and doing their own thing in that sense.
Well, I think there are certain kinds, and playing Go or chess is an example where, through speed and playing against themselves thousands of times in an hour, they can learn very fast. And that's similar with learning to interpret x-rays of lungs and all that. They can do these things. But I think it's important to bear in mind that there's a rather complicated gap between what machines can do well and what they can't do well. What Jim said about medicine, that's one example. It's certainly not the case that white-collar jobs are going to be harder to automate than blue-collar jobs. I mean, I suspect computer coding can be done by machines. A lot of routine legal conveyancing and things like that can be mechanized. But on the other hand, plumbing, I suspect, can't. The plumber who comes and has to poke around in your roof to find where there's a leak, one can't see a robot doing that in the near future. And in gardening, it's true that you can go from having a spade to having a bulldozer, but neither of those can design a nice garden. And so I think gardening is another so-called blue-collar job, which is going to be very hard to replace. So I think there's going to be a sort of redistribution of human labour, but it's going to be a rather complicated, and of course in most cases the machine is going to be supplementary or enhancing the role of a human rather than usurping
it. And I mean, do you have any fears, and this is, you know, the stuff of sci-fi movies and books and so on, but that humans might at some point, as it were, become fed up with the number of robots taking their jobs, and perhaps they're not seeing the benefits, you know, that should accrue from all these labor-saving devices, rather they're just feeling that I'm being left behind and so on. Is there any danger of a sort of, I don't know, Luddite kind of smashing of the robots kind of rebellion or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't call it a danger necessarily, because it may very well be that we decide that we want to slow down the development of some kind of technology because it's not cost-effective, it's not beneficial. That has happened. If you look at the history of technologies, some have developed very, very fast. Smartphones, for instance, which have spread around the world far faster than anyone predicted. But on the other hand, supersonic flight. We're still using the same kind of planes as we were over 50 years ago. The jumbo jet first flew in 1969. Concorde came and went, and that's an example where we could have had a rapid development of technology, but it was thought it wasn't commercially or socially acceptable. And so in the same way, it may well be decided that we don't want to develop these technologies further. I think in the smartphone, maybe that's saturated. Maybe the iPhone 24 will be not too different from the iPhone 13, and that's an example. So technologies, they develop fast and then plateau, and that's because of lack of public demand or concerns, and that may very well happen to some of these uses of machine learning.
I mean, John, I'd just
but
be
you should welcome it.
I'd just be interested, John, in your perspective, because another big sort of concern that's often raised is the idea of a singularity, or at some point, you know, the machines sort of take over and sort of decide humans are dissensible, you know, we can get on better with the job we've got in front of us without humans. I mean, is that just, again, sci-fi, or do you think there's a genuine concern that we could be heading in that sort of direction, John?
Well, I think the idea of a singularity, which is that at some point we suddenly create super intelligent machines, and then they get, you know, within a few minutes they become so ridiculously intelligent they then take over the world. You know, this is just pure science fiction and is not a genuine risk. I think the risks of AI are much more to do with malevolent human beings using AI for nefarious purposes, and you know, the power of the simulation and of deception is absolutely enormous. But going back to what I do think I see happening, and that is an increasing, quotes, virtualization of many people's experience. I mean, we've already spending so much time, aren't we, sitting on our backside staring at screens, and as the new generations of virtual reality and augmented reality become available, I think there are going to be increasing numbers of our society who start to think actually living in a digital world is preferable. You know, in the real world, I have got no money, I've got rampant inflation, we've got warfare, we've got, you know, I'm hanging on by my fingertips, the oil price and so on. I go into my virtual world and all of a sudden, it's fantastic. I mean, I can do whatever I want to do. Mm-hmm. I can experience, I can pretend to play roles. And, you know, this kind of dystopic view of the future where actually the virtual starts to become more and more attractive, I think that's a real threat.
Mm. Yeah. Do you agree with that, Martin?
It's like being on drugs that distort your perception of reality. And so I agree, it would be deplorable if that happened, and we are heading that way.
So I think one of the real questions then is, what is it? Because there are, I mean, although Martin and I tend to agree a lot, there are a lot of people out there who would take the contrary view, and they would say, this is the future. This is the way it's going. And rather than be Luddites like we are and say, isn't it terrible, you know, we should embrace the future, that the future of humanity is in this virtual, merging with the virtual. I mean, Elon Musk, for instance, well-known entrepreneur, is saying the only hope for us as human beings made out of meat is that we've got to find a way of connecting ourselves to the digital technology so that it doesn't take over. So, I mean, how we respond to that, I think, is going to be really important in the future.
Well, indeed. And, of course, if we got too dependent, then we'd be vulnerable to breakdowns. And, of course, one of the things that I worry about very much is, as you already said, malevolent use of these powerful technologies, which enable just one person or a few people cause a massive cyber attack which shuts down the electric grid or something like that, or more insidiously, just breakdowns which are so complicated to track down and repair that we become helpless. So there's a big risk that as these things get more complicated, then we become far more vulnerable. And that's another reason for not becoming too dependent on these things. And also that the other new thing is that they span the globe in many cases. So if something goes wrong, it's not localized in the way that most disasters were in the past. It could spread globally. And one of the themes in my book is indeed that what a new concern is that cascades globally can occur from bio or cyber errors or terrors.
Well, look, we're going to go to a quick break and we'll be back to conclude today's discussion. And I'd like to talk about in the next segment sort of that concept, which I think left someone like, I think it was Max Tegmark, you know, wept on the side of the street when he considered the idea that one day humans would be completely replaced by robots, you know, stretching far out into the galaxy. Who knows? And we'll talk about maybe what that looks like in the future. But we'll come back to all that. My guests today are Martin Rees and John Wyatt. We're talking today about robots, about transhumanism, life beyond Earth, and much more besides. We'll be back very shortly.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Matters of Life and Death. Tune in next week for the final instalment of this big conversation between John and Martin Rees. As always, there's plenty more to read, listen to, and watch if you're interested in going deeper on Dad's website. You can find it at www.johnwyatt.com. And to get in touch with us, with your thoughts or feedback, simply email MOLAD, that's MOLAD, at premier.org.uk. Happy New Year, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.